Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the sermon from our January 10th service. Both Rick Cote and Reverend Bruce Bodie will speak on the topic, Life Koans. Thanks for listening.
Our sermon message this morning is split into two parts with both Rick Cote and myself delivering the message, and in between our messages, our quintet will be singing. So, Rick.
Well, good morning. I'm Rick Cote. I was introduced to the Unitarians in San Francisco in the early 1970s. I'll leave it to your imagination what that church was like. And meditation in the mid-60s, well, I was attending college in Ashland, Oregon. While walking to class one day, I saw a fellow college student dressed in black robes and a shaved head, and he didn't look like the other students. He didn't look like me, and I soon discovered he was a Zen monk there to learn to be a nurse. So he first taught me meditation, and I sat with him for couple years. Earlier this fall, I was meeting with Bruce about a very different thing when somehow I brought up the idea of life koans, something he had never heard of before, but in which he was immediately interested. And thus, the invitation to join him in the pulpit this morning to talk about this subject, and something I'm very happy to do. Now, koans are from the Zen school of Buddhism and originally from China, but really were picked up in recent times and used by the Rinzai school of Japanese Zen. This work with koans is very attractive to some, probably the most famous to us that I know of is James Ismail Ford, who is a Zen Roshi and a Unitarian minister. He said he was very drawn to koan work, and if you read about his own explorations, koan work is kind of the center part of his spiritual practice. Another person I assume did koan work, though she never shared it with me, was Florence Kaplow, as her teacher worked with koans, so I'm assuming she did. Now, koans are described as paradoxes, puzzles, riddles. A very classic one is, what is mu? Or what is the sound of one hand clapping? Those are very short, some are very long. And a very classic collection, if you're interested in koans, is the Blue Cliff Records, you know, where you can go and read all of the koans. They are given by a teacher, and then you ponder it, you sit with it. You actually, different schools do different things with it. But then you meet with the teacher in a private meeting called Dokusan, and give your answer to the koan, and if the teacher likes your answer, you get another one. Now, it is not uncommon to stay with one koan for a long time. I think an average is 6 months, something like this, I think. I knew someone that worked on a koan, single koan, for 35 years. So you can go a long time. Now, I personally have very little experience with koans. My only experience was at a retreat on Vashon Island with a teacher that does koans, and where I was given the classic, what was your original face before your mother and father were born? Now, I sat with this koan and then met with the teacher where he asked, what is your original face before your mother and father were born? Now, I knew the answers to these koans is often nonverbal, so this is what I said to him. To which he said, "This and only this?" And my answer was, disappointing. That was the end of the interview. Now, the retreat was long enough that I actually had a second meeting with him. So he asked me again, "What was your original face before your mother and father was born?" Thinking I should answer differently, I answered this way. "This and only this?" To which I answered, disappointing. And the interview was done. And so was my koan work. Now, my wife, she's done a lot of retreats, but she decided to try koan work herself. And she tells me that her response, he threw her out, So we have this ongoing discussion whether disappointing or throwing you out was worse, Now, you may have decided, while I'm talking, that the Zen teacher was right, and he is disappointing. But I'm sure you will not tell me, as Unitarians are much nicer than Zen teachers. Now, life koans are very different, and they really actually come from humanistic psychology rather than Buddhism. Life koans are not given to you, and you do not have multiple ones. And you do not have to talk to a teacher about it, though I have talked to a teacher about mine. They come from your own experience. Think of things you see as special. So it's those things that touch you that are special. Of this group of things, is there something in this pool of special that's this? If there is something that calls to you, that stands out, it might be a life koan. Now, I did not talk to Joseph Benarek about this, and I might be wrong, but remember when he gave the sermon on the Spanish poet Anthony Machado and his poem that goes, "Mankind owns four things that are not good at sea, rudder, anchor, oars, and the fear of going down." This, to me, is a koan. It really cannot be understood in a rational way. My guess was this might be a life koan to him, or what he shares after each of his talks, where he says, "Beyond sleeping and dreaming, the most important thing is waking up." I think this speaks to him. It obviously speaks to us. That's why he does it, But I think it particularly speaks to him. Mine is when I went to the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center. Now, the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center is very remote. It is way up in the Rockies. And to get there, you have to take a prop plane from Denver into this, that lands in this open field. And you get off this prop plane and you wait for someone from the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center to come down this long mountain road, takes about 30 minutes, to take you up to the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center. Now, while you wait in this open field, you kind of know that everyone else is going to the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center because, like, you're standing in this open field, it's like they're not going somewhere else, And so there was five of us total, four other people, and we were sitting there waiting, and eventually this station wagon came down this mountain road and picked us up. And we went up to the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center. And as is common in this kind of practice, it was in silence. Nobody was talking to each other. So for about 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, half the way, it was in silence. Out of the silence, the driver turned to us and she asked, ex-Catholics or ex-Jews? Now, I immediately thought, these are my only choices? And I actually had a chance to talk to her afterwards, and she shared that she was doing a little bit of research of who shows up at the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, you know, and she was just amazed at how many people were ex-Catholics and ex-Jews, you know. And she said that occasionally other people come, but it was pretty rare. In this car, you know, she was right. And she certainly had me, because I'm an ex-Catholic. And there was one other person in the car that was an ex-Catholic, and the other three were ex-Jews. To me and the other ex-Catholic, she turned to me and she said, "Are you pursuing the glorious possibility?" I had never thought about it this way, but I was sure she was right, that I was here doing this because of that. To the Jews, she said, "Are you here escaping despair?" And they all said they were. And I've actually had this chance to talk with even a rabbi and a Jewish congregation, and everyone agreed. But it's not mine to say about that part. Pursuing the glorious possibility was mine. It was special to me. Now, through the years, I have thought about this phrase a lot. And recently, I have thought a lot about the first word in it, pursuing. Now, what my reflections on pursuing comes to is that, you know, two things get in the way of my pursuing. One is putzy. I can just amazingly putz for a very long time, you know. I mean, when I look at my whole day, it's just an amazing amount of it. And maybe you're more directed and more disciplined than I am, but I putz an incredible amount. You know? The other one, and I think this would happen to Unitarians, is it could, you know, my pursuits get crowded out by other pursuits. I think, oh, that's special, I should do this. That's special, I should do this. That's special, I should do this. And I end up doing all these kinds of things. And so, you know, that special gets crowded out. I mean, you know, I still spend some time with it, but not at the, you know, these other things that I have to do, that I want to do. And it was very helpful to me to start seeing that this one was special, that this one shouldn't be crowded out. I needed to do this one. You know? Now, what I've thought about, of course, the most, is not pursuit, but the glorious possibility. And there's many thoughts I've had about it that I could share with you, but I would like to do one image. So if you can imagine this little boy that's 5 years old that is sitting in a church one Sunday with his mother on one side and his father on the other, and his brother and sister are there. And he is not devout. You know, in fact, he's very impatient and wants the service to get over so he can go home and watch cartoons or play. He's hoping that the service is led by Father McLeod, which is very fast. It won't be as long. He sits there. And from the back of the church, the choir starts singing Gregorian chants. They're not in English. He doesn't know what they mean. It's not like the music he hears at home. But it is haunting. Down the center of the aisle comes the priest, who's in multicolored robes. And he's swinging a gold chain with a brass cage, swinging it like this. And at the top of the swing, out of the brass cage comes a puff of smoke and a clank. And about 15 seconds later, you start smelling frankincense and myrrh. And the little boy gets transported somewhere. He's no longer thinking of cartoons or going somewhere or playing. He's not thinking about anything. He's just gone. Now, rationally, probably was a short period of time. I would think 15, 30 seconds. And yet this little boy, 60 years later, stands up in a church, a very different church, and he talks about it.
And I want to thank Rick for so thoughtfully sharing his ideas with us this morning in relation to this concept of life koans, which, as he mentioned, is a new term for me that came up earlier this fall when we were in conversation on some other matter. And actually, the term that he first used was not life koans, but lifetime koans, which immediately struck a chord with me, and it's actually a term I somewhat prefer. The idea being, as I take it, that there may be something that you stumble across in life and perhaps keep stumbling across that asks you to attend to it, and then when you finally do, it changes the whole course of your life, how you regard your individual life, how you regard life in general. And I think in this regard of something I once heard Joseph Campbell say about fairy tales, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but it had to do with an individual walking along in a field, just strolling along in a field, and all of a sudden catching, stumbling, and then stopping, and behold, pulling up something, and now a whole new passageway into a whole new world opens up. Fairy tales like that. This is what I was reminded of, so that I think of a lifetime koan as something that trips you up, draws you in, puzzles you deeply, so that now you spend a whole lifetime pondering it, walking around it, and conversing with it. It might be a statement of some kind. It could be a poetic verse. It could be a melody line in a song. Maybe it's some movie that has grabbed you, a painting, a story of some kind. It could be a dream that grips you and haunts you. I think in this regard of my friend Robert Johnson, the Jungian analyst, in his book Balancing Heaven and Earth. In the beginning of that book, he talks about a dream that came to him in his mid-20s. He spent the rest of his life unpacking that dream. And so as I see it, the invitation that Rick is putting before us this morning is to consider whether there might be something in your life that would fit into this category of being a life Cohen for you. I don't assume that everyone would connect with this, but it is an invitation to think about the things that have moved you, puzzled you, the things that have returned to you again and again and again in the course of your life. And here you are being invited to consider whether this thing that has caught your attention is not something that is just interesting or special in the lower case form that Rick pointed to, but is interesting, special in the uppercase way. And that reminds me of another thing, a second thing that Joseph Campbell spoke about, namely a practice that they have in India of drawing a red ring around an object. When Campbell was in India, he noted that on occasion he would see these red rings drawn around an object. It might be an object of any kind, say a peculiar looking stone or a tree. It might be a flower, it might be a child, it might be a cow. Symbolically speaking, in India, all cows have a red ring around them. They're special. And so the idea of drawing a red ring around an object is to change your orientation to it so that you now behold the object not in its everyday, ordinary, practical dimension, but you behold it, as the Easterners say, in its isness, its suchness. You move the object from ordinary to extraordinary time, from what I think of as the horizontal dimension. You move it from the horizontal dimension to the vertical dimension. By drawing a red ring around an object, you therefore make of it a shrine, a sanctuary place, it becomes holy ground upon which you stand. And so too, to consider something as a life Cohen, you now look at what has already been interesting to you in a heightened way. It's an invitation to consider this life Cohen as relating to your particular destiny, your particular piece of real estate in this vast universe, your soul's code, as it has been said. A life Cohen is an invitation to consider at the deepest level who you are, how you are made, and what you might offer. It's not about others. It's about your particularity, your singularity. A life Cohen belongs to you, not to others. Others can't tell you what yours is or ought to be. And as I see it, this life Cohen is a place where you most deeply enter reality. And where you most deeply enter reality, that individual place, that singular place, is paradoxically also the place where you meet the universal. It's in the depth of the particular that the universal comes forward. It's where the part connects to the whole. And I think of it like moving from the circumference of a wheel, following a spoke from that circumference all the way down to the center, to the hub of the wheel. So let me, as Rick did, speak to you about what has a red ring drawn around it for me. Because when Rick mentioned that idea of a lifetime Cohen in our conversation, I didn't have to think for a moment. Immediately, I new or immediately a lifetime koan came to my mind. And since I enjoy games, and since I've now been with you for about 12 years, and since I've given sermons that might relate to this lifetime koan, does anyone here want to take a guess at what my lifetime koan, what I would regard as my lifetime koan? Anyone here have an idea? I'll give. I see two hands. First, go ahead. Why is there something rather than nothing? Yes, you. Thank you. I'm so gratified that people are actually listening to my, what I have to say. And the first service, too, just like that, they got it. So this is a statement. It's the question, actually, that I stumbled across 40 years ago. I was a theological student. I was reading the works of theologian Paul Tillich. And I came across this passage where he says, the most basic religious philosophical question one can ask is, why is there something rather than nothing? Not a question that can be answered in the normal way that you answer questions, but indeed it's more like a classical Eastern koan, such as Rick was given, what was your original face before your mother and father were born? And it's a question, as Tillich says, that has to do with what is called the metaphysical shock. It's the shock of possible non-being, and that metaphysical shock through that question certainly struck me, and it's been reverberating with me in those words ever since. So even though this is considered a basic question in philosophy, still, it's my question. It's my life koan. It's special for me. Not everyone is touched or taken by this question in the way that I am. Actually, I'm often somewhat, not as much anymore, but I was hesitant for years to say that this was an interesting question, because I would sometimes, people would say, why is there something rather than nothing? That's an interesting question. That, but you know, what, of course there's something rather than nothing, you fool. Well, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Hey, what can you get out of that question? So I don't have time to go into the depth of the meaning of this question for me. My latest sermon on this topic was delivered last November. And it was actually under this title, Why Is There Something Rather Than Nothing? You can find it on the website if you want to pursue it. But in summary, I'll just say that this question is at the root of my religious philosophy. As I contemplate this question, my religious philosophy, I see, comes out of that. And that root just gets deeper in me as the years go by. Contemplating this life koan has first of all to do with the basic surprise and wonder that I feel that there is something rather than nothing. It's the feeling that in me that there's no necessity for anything having to be, and yet here it all is, here we are, and I don't know, it moves me somehow. It doesn't move everybody, but it moves me. It's surprising to me. It's astounding to me. Secondly, there's the amazement that there is mind to know it. Thirdly, there is the awareness that I am a part of it. Fourthly, there's gratitude for being able to witness the beauty of the something that is rather than the nothing that is not. And fifthly, it's the sympathy of feeling the pain and struggle in the nature of being and becoming. It's the sense that I have that our pain is larger than just something that belongs to humanity or to individuals, but it's part of a larger struggle within the depths of being itself as it propels itself forward. And then finally, there's an ongoing question, namely, does it have some kind of urge in it toward what we humans call the good? In other words, what is the status of the moral imperative within us? So each of these statements that I've given you and this question has already been the basis of a sermon or two, and I expect many more in the future. But I'll stop there for today and simply thank Rick for deepening the importance of a question that was already important to me, so that now I draw a red ring around it. I approach it as a lifetime koan, which is to say, I approach that question with both greater consciousness and greater sacredness. So thank you, Rick.
No sin in him.
You have just heard Ubi Caritas by Durafle and I Will Not Leave You Comfortless by Bird, performed by Linda Bach, Colleen Johnson, Doug and Pat Rogers, and Mike Wallace.